Full employment used to be an explicit goal of economic policy in most of the industrialized world. Some countries even achieved it. In Back to Full Employment, economist Robert Pollin argues that the United States, today faced with its highest level of unemployment since the Great Depression, should put full employment back on the agenda. There are good reasons to seek full employment, Pollin writes. Full employment will help individuals, families, and the economy as a whole while promoting equality and social stability. Equally important, creating a full employment economy can be joined effectively with two other fundamental policy aims: ending our dependence on fossil fuels and creating an economy powered by clean energy. In the end, achieving full employment will be a matter of political will. The question, can the United States make having a decent job a fundamental right? We'll discuss this morning with Robert Pollin, professor of economics and co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute of the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Robert Pollin, welcome to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
I'm glad to be on. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for taking the time out and for talking to us about these important issues. At what point did we last see full employment?
Well, in the late 1990s, the official unemployment rate fell below 4%, so around 3.5%. So that's not 100% employment, 0% unemployment, but it's really to the point at which we are getting the benefits of full employment, which is most everybody has a job. And on top of that, workers' bargaining power went up significantly, even at the low end of the wage scale, so that workers got raises for the first time in a generation. So I would say the late 1990s, and I would just add that what happened in the 90s was this financial bubble that pushed us to such low unemployment. And the goal that I'm talking about is getting back there, but not having to rely on a financial bubble, investing in productive activities.
And, of course, we take into account all of those because we use the statistics that we are given are those who are ultimately filing for unemployment benefits, correct? So we don't even get an accurate picture of the people who are out of the job market altogether.
We don't. We adjust the figures. The initial figures, such as the ones that came out on Friday, are based on telephone surveys, where the government surveyors call people, and they also call businesses, and that's where we get those numbers. But yes, you're right. The best numbers come from when it takes a couple more months when we get data on people filing for unemployment insurance.
So has there been a point where we have seen such employment done in a more natural way, in the sense of not this bubble as you described in the late 1990s, but we achieved it through ways and means that you describe in the book?
Yeah, I think that certainly in the 1960s. So there were two periods over the last 50 years in which we had unemployment below 4%. That was the late 1960s and the late 1990s. In the late 1960s, we got there through government policies explicitly designed to promote full employment. And yes, on top of that, we got it through spending on the Vietnam War, which also injected more spending and jobs into the economy. So those are the two periods in this country. In Europe, from the end of World War II, roughly the 1950s through mid-1970s, the countries of Europe were operating on average at about 2% unemployment rate. So they were operating at full employment for a good 20 years. Sweden went still longer with it. So there are good examples of countries, capitalist countries, operating at full employment.
Obviously, a key to this latest presidential campaign was the talk of job creation and economic recovery. There were plans put forward, some more spelled out than others. From what you heard, was anybody on the right track?
Well, of the two candidates, you won't be surprised to hear me say that I think Obama was on a better track, because Obama's is focused on, to some extent, not as much as I would like, but certainly to some extent, on investing in infrastructure, investing in the green economy to create jobs, on getting money for education into the hands of state and local governments. He was less obsessed with the idea of the government's deficit being too big. The government's deficit is not the problem of the day. The problem of the day is jobs. And so I do think that Obama was more on the right track. The problem, of course, is if Obama thinks something, that isn't as important as what he can get through Congress. And right now, we are stuck in this debate, the so-called fiscal cliff debate, in which the overarching issue is said to be the government's fiscal deficit, not unemployment. So it's the wrong debate to start off. There's problems with the details of the debate, but it's the wrong debate to start off, and I wish Obama would say that more vehemently.
How much power do you believe the president has in this regard, in the sense of when we're talking about full employment, is this something that can be dictated by policy?
Absolutely not, of course. But the president is an important player in policy, and it is the policy framework will be the thing that establishes or doesn't establish full employment. We can get to full employment through policy. Obviously, the private market is the dominant force in the economy, but the public sector frames things. The public sector channels our resources, our financial resources, into either job-creating activities or into the financial casino. The public sector can help promote things like investing in the green economy, which is a good source of job creation over time. So it is the government's role. The president has the most power of any government official, but obviously there's a lot of pushes and pulls between various factions in the government.
What pushes would you like to see him make and to see Congress and the Senate make?
Yeah, well, the easiest thing and the one that could have a lot of effect with no impact on government spending is to move the money that private banks are sitting on. They're sitting on $1.4 trillion in cash hoards, and they have been sitting on it now for a couple of years. This is money the banks got for free from the Fed because the Federal Reserve has set the interest rate for banks at close to zero, essentially zero. So it's free money. I'm not against that policy of giving them the very, very cheap money because it could be useful, but the money, for it to be useful, the money can't just stay with the banks. It has to go out of the banks' coffers into the hands of small businesses in particular. They are big sources of job creation. They are strapped for credit. This money, we therefore need policies to get this money out of the bank's hands and into the hands of business who will create jobs.
Given that we always hear from economists that say that some level of unemployment is necessary if we are going to keep inflation in check, how do we factor that into full employment and the arguments?
I think there's a reasonable case to be concerned about too much inflationary pressure if you get unemployment in the range of 3%. But since we're nowhere near that, that is not really the serious issue now. Once you get to, say, 3%, workers do have more bargaining power. If they bargain up their wages, businesses will try to pass on those cost increases to consumers in the form of higher prices. That's where you get the inflation. But that's not happening now. We're nowhere close to that. So if we have inflation in the economy today, which we do not have, but if we were to have it, it would come from oil prices going up fast, not from workers having too much bargaining power. So that issue of inflation is not a concern right now. It could be in a few years. But right now, let's deal with the problem before us, which is getting people back into decent jobs.
Robert Polin is professor of economics and co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. The new book is Back to Full Employment. It is published by Boston Review. When you look at the numbers that came out Friday, what's the good news?
Well, the good news is what the headline was, that the unemployment rate went down from 7.9 to 7.7%. Unfortunately, underlying that is much less good news, which is that there was no new job creation at all. The reason the unemployment rate went down was because 350,000 people dropped out of the labor force. They stopped looking for work. So actually, we kind of treaded water. The good news, therefore, is, well, at least things didn't get worse, and at least we're seeing some glimmers of things going in the right direction. We've just got a long way to go, because with those people that are officially unemployed, so that's about 12 million, and then you're going to add another 12 million of people who would like full-time jobs but have part-time jobs, and people who have dropped out of the labor force. So we're looking at in the range of 24 million people who are either unemployed or underemployed, who don't have the kind of jobs that they need to sustain themselves and their families. So the good news is things didn't get worse, but we need to do a lot more to create some really seriously good news.
No matter what the issue, whether it be economic or whether it be social or whether it be environmental, I find myself so often asking the question to academics and to scholars and experts like yourself who make the case of how we can change things and make things better. You ask at the end of the book the very question that I ask all the time, which is, if not now, when? And at what point do we say, well, all right, what more do you need to see before we do something about it?
Right. That is a quote, though I didn't give the full quote. That is a quote from a 12th century Jewish sage, Rabbi Hillel, who asked that question. And it's a fair question now. It's the right question, because we've really been battered. I mean, the U.S. economy, the global economy, really got battered by this recession. It's the most severe recession since the 1930s. So it's time to think about some structural changes, to do things differently, to do things in ways that focus more on the well-being of ordinary people. And if that means regulating Wall Street, and which it does, and if it means raising taxes on wealthy people, which it does, so be it. In fact, it's to the better, because we had a more equal society 40 years ago. We had lower unemployment rates, we had more stability, and people could raise their families in ways that is becoming increasingly difficult. So let's set the basic standards and figure out the best policy tools to get there. And the best single measure for building a stable society is to create opportunities for everybody to have jobs, decent jobs. That should be the bedrock, and we can build out from there.
And as you point out, some of this is short term, some of this is long term, and it has to be a dual approach.
Right. In the short term, the types of things we just talked about, which is like moving the money out of the banks. Eventually, I assume the money will move out of the banks. It hasn't happened yet, but there's never been a time in history where the banks have been hoarding this much money, which amounts to about 10% of entire GDP. So that's a short-term measure. Over the long term, we have to build a green economy because we face the threat of climate change. And building a green economy will help us in our manufacturing sector, and it will create a lot of jobs, because when you spend $1 million on the green economy, you create 17 jobs, more or less. When you spend $1 million on maintaining our existing fossil fuel economy, you create 5 jobs, more or less. So you create 3 times more jobs per dollar of expenditure by investing in green, and on top of that, we are addressing our long-term ecological challenges of climate change through those investments.
One of the things that came to my mind in reading the book, and I'm curious as to how you feel about this. If we were to adopt this and say that this is the manifesto, and as a culture and as a society and as a political entity, we drink this Kool-Aid.
Can we switch the metaphor?
Yes. And we adopt this, okay?
Okay.
How sustainable is it? How long can it last? Or will there always be ebbs and flows, ups and downs?
Well, of course there's going to be ebbs and flows. And, of course, you know, I wrote down these policy ideas, and the book is tiny, by the way. So, you know, these are ideas. I think they're quite solid. They're backed up by research. But in implementation, nothing is going to work out as well as I sketched it out in the book. So there will be ebbs and flows. There will be some problems. There will be corruption. There will be disappointment. We will learn more by doing things. But the basic framework, I think, is rock solid. The basic framework that we establish some principles, and I can call them ethical or moral principles, that economic policy should be organized around the principle that everyone deserves the right to a decent job. So we start there. Then what are our tools? Well, then we build out, we think about short-term tools and long-term tools like we've just been talking about. All of these things, these tools, they're quite feasible. They're things that are operating now. It's a matter of having a stronger commitment, building them to scale, making things bigger. And within that framework, the private sector can flourish. I'm not suggesting that we not have a private sector operating or that the private sector not have a chance to do things the way it wants to do things. I'm talking about keeping the private sector operating within a broad range of freedom for them to do as they wish within a set of government policies that promote decent employment for everybody.
I let this go when you were first talking about it because I just wanted to save it for the end, and that is this talk about the fiscal cliff, and as you pointed out, in your opinion, we're having the wrong argument, the wrong debate when it comes to what the problem is in your opinion. So is there anything that any good that can come from positive results and positive talks to avoid the so-called fiscal cliff?
Well, again, the starting point for me is that we're not in a financial crisis. The federal government's interest on the debt, the amount we pay out every month, is at near historic lows, not historic highs. We're not like Greece. We're not like Spain. They have serious issues of short-term fiscal solvency that we simply do not have. So that said, now some positive things that could come out of it would be to cut the military budget, which is gargantuan, way out of size, out of historical proportion, and to restore reasonable tax rates for wealthy people. Those two things are on the table. They would be positive. The trouble is the other things on the table, cutting social spending, raising taxes on the middle class, and I think the Trump card that's kind of not even being discussed openly, but is there, is the idea of making permanent reductions in Social Security and Medicare. These are absolutely unnecessary to do. They would constitute a severe attack on the living standard of non-wealthy people in this country. It's not fair. It's not necessary. We can get out of the recession and restore fiscal stability without doing those things.
What do you think we'll end up with?
Well, you know as much as I do, if not more, probably a whole lot more, because at this point it's not about what the economics are, it's about bargaining. I think...
Well, it seems like we're going to end up somewhere in the middle, right?
Somewhere in the middle. It's a question of where in the middle.
Right.
And I really think that it would be a travesty if the part of the middle that gets tossed in are permanent reductions in the benefits to people relying on Social Security and Medicare. We, you know, looking at over the big, big, big picture, the economy is now twice as productive as it was only 40 years ago. Why in the world would we therefore have to think that we can't afford to maintain benefits for people who need health care or people who are on pensions at least the level that we had 40 years ago? We can easily do it. It's not an economic problem. It's a political problem.
The name of the book is Back to Full Employment. Robert Pollan is the author. It's a fascinating book. It is published by Boston Review. Again, it is Back to Full Employment. And as Robert mentioned, it's a very accessible small book in which there's a lot of information, a lot of great ideas in a book, and very concise. Robert Pollan is professor of economics and co-director of the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Robert, always a pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me on.
I appreciate it. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.